Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. Heidi Scheid was walking the supermarket aisles one day and she noticed that even dog food makers were making so-called better-for-you options. What she realised that day is what most of the wine trade missed, that consumers were actively looking for low-alcohol, low-sugar, better health options, even for their pets. And that's how the power brand Sunny with a Chance of Flowers was born. It's 9% alcohol by volume, it's got zero sugar, and it's been winning 90-point scores. Heidi explained to me how Scheid Family Wines went from being a Monterey-based grape supplier to a wine branding powerhouse and did it in under 2 decades. And I learned a lot. For example, I learned what strip water is and why you need a skew rat in your life. And now this is your opportunity to find out more about those things as well. And for even more insights, don't forget to subscribe to the Drinks Insider newsletter at drinksinsider.com. Heidi, when I was looking up your background, I see that you started out at Ernst & Young. So my first question is, was that a shock entering the wine trade from a much more business-focused background?
Well, that was a long time ago. That was back in 1992, before we had a winery and before we had branded goods. So we were a grape grower. So it was an agricultural operation that required a lot of planning because we had long-term supply contracts. So I think the shock was how much our business was dependent upon Mother Nature. That was, and the seasonality of it, like that was a big shock. But I think the real shock for me came many years later when we got into finished goods distribution and how different distributing alcohol is than most any other industry that exists.
Well, that's actually why we're here today to talk about this. So the business went from supplying grapes to creating labels. So that is a massive leap. And I think that was, what, 2009 that happened?
2012. And there was a little, there was a step in between in that we built a winery in 2005. So, you know, we started off as a grape grower and that's what we did for 30 years. We supplied wine grapes to other wineries. Some of those long-term contracts that the company was built on back in 1972 began expiring. We had a very large supply contract with Diageo. It didn't start with Diageo. It ended up with Diageo. It started with Almaden back in 1972. And we, you know, blissfully thought that those contracts would go on forever because surely Diageo would always need wine grapes. And so it was quite surprising when we got notice that, in fact, Diageo was exiting the wine business and would no longer need 60% of the grapes that we were growing. Goodness. So we really had to pivot. This was back in like about 2000. So we really had to pivot and start finding new customers for our grapes. And what we found out were a lot of these wineries wanted wine made to their specification versus grapes because they were out of processing capability themselves. Their wineries were at capacity. So we built a winery.
A lot of people have tried to do that, but almost none of them have succeeded the way that you have. So talk me through the steps. So how did you go from growing grapes to learning how to make wine? Did you take it to a crush facility? Did you hire a winemaker? What did you do in the early days?
For the first couple of years, we made wine at custom crush facilities. We were making wine at 7 different facilities. We had hired a winemaker to go to all the different facilities. And it was a great learning experience. I mean, obviously, we knew about making wine because we've been growing grapes for 30 years. And, you know, oftentimes we would meet with our grape clients to taste the wines made from our grapes. But there's nothing like actually making the wine yourself and understanding the impact that your farming decisions have on the ultimate quality of the wine. So we did that for 3 years. And when we built our winery, we broke ground in 2005, we were really able to kind of take the best that we had learned from crushing in other facilities and apply them to the design of our own winery.
So what was the idea then, that you're going to do DTC, that you were always going to be a retail brand, or were you working on private label at that stage?
Well, in 2005, I mean, we really saw ourselves as being a supplier to other wineries. And so we didn't really imagine that we were going to add, we always say it's adding the third leg on the stool of actually producing brands. We were pretty happy being a supplier and working very collaboratively with other wineries. But what began to happen is we would help build these very successful brands, you know, being a mainstay of their blend, and then they would get sold. So we sold a lot of Pinot Noir for the Mark West label. We for years were supplier to the Coppola Diamond series. You know, these were wonderful partnerships. But ultimately, you know, those brands got sold, and then we were sort of left having to rebuild all over again. So in some ways, you know, adding that third leg on a stool and launching our finished goods division was really a tactic to protect ourselves. It was almost a defensive move in some sense of like, hey, we've been growing grapes for these wineries for years, at that point, you know, 40 years, and now we're making wine for these wine labels. Why don't we actually build our own wine labels?
I mean, this is the bit that the story gets really interesting from a business point of view, because there's a very big difference to supplying a commodity to suddenly creating a brand. How did you do it? Did you go, we'll just, you know, stumble into it and see what happens? Did you call in expertise? Like, what steps did you take?
Well, we hired somebody. We hired a head of sales, a super smart guy, John Holter, who I worked with for 13 years. And John and I really worked together. I mean, it was a lot of stumbling. And honestly, if I had known how difficult it was going to be, I'm not sure I would have had the courage to really do that. But we soon found out that even though we had thousands of acres of beautiful vineyards in the Central Coast, we were in the Monterey Appellation, and we had this beautiful state-of-the-art winery that had the capacity to produce over 2 million cases of wine, that distributors weren't really excited to get into business with us because we had no case production. So in 2012, we were producing 2,500 cases under our Scheid Vineyards label that was sold entirely direct to consumer. And we were making it at another winery. So to really try to launch off of that and build a finished goods division was pretty daunting. We realized that we were going to have to bring the business to the distributor before the distributor was interested in doing business with us. And the way that we did that was by forming relationships with the buyers at accounts. You know, back then, this is 2012, private label and wine was definitely there, and it was starting to grow. A lot of the larger wineries at that point really didn't want to go in that direction. You know, the big successful wineries, you know, the top 20 wineries, they had their own national global brands that they wanted to focus on. And so it really created an opening for us to get in there and to be able to show a large national retailer, hey, look, we've got the vineyards, we've got the winery, we have the ability to scale, we are going to give you consistent quality from vintage to vintage. And very importantly, we're going to treat this brand like it's precious because we need it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, sitting in Europe where private label is about 50% of the market, it's always interesting that I think it's growing in the US, but that resistance to actually doing it, because it's a pretty good source of income for many people. What do you think is behind that resistance? And is that changing in the US?
The resistance of wineries producing private labels? Yeah, oh, absolutely. I think it very much has changed. You know, we were kind of just in there in this little opening. I think it had changed, you know, 5 years after we kind of got into it. I think all the wineries now produce private label, exclusive brands, you know, and here in the US, you know, sometimes those labels are owned by the account. I mean, you think of like Costco and their extraordinarily successful Kirkland Ranch label. You know, Aldi owns most of their own IP. And then there's other national retailers where it's on the winery to create the brand name, the brand story, to really invest on the marketing side of it. So I think that's where wineries maybe had a more difficult time changing their mindset, because again, they're focused on their own national brands that they're trying to build that market.
That's really interesting. I hadn't occurred to me that you actually had to build a brand as well for some of them. So first of all, how many private, at the biggest, how many private labels did you or do you make?
At the biggest, I think we had about 80.
80? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
8-0.
8-0. Not all real successful, but most of them pretty successful. I mean, we have, some of the original exclusive brands that we did back in, 2012, 2013 are still around and doing very, very well. Our first one that we launched was called Hive and Honey with Kroger, and we met with Kroger and they said, we would really love to do business with you, but you need to kind of create a brand for us that we don't already have. You need to find like the white space in our portfolio. So we looked at all of their stats and all their private labels and we said, you know what? You don't have a private label Gewürztraminer.
Right.
And they didn't. So we created Hive and Honey. It was actually a Gewürztraminer and a Riesling. And that was our very first kind of national exclusive brand that we did with Kroger. And it's still on the shelf and it still does really, really well.
Well, let's talk about how you create brands. So, I mean, most people, if they were going the white space, probably wouldn't jump into a Gewürztraminer and a Riesling. What made you go, that's what they need?
It was an odd choice.
But what was the decision tree that led you to go?
It was literally it was literally the only gap that they had. Like they had, we're in the Central Coast. Like we want to do a Chardonnay, a Pinot Noir, a Sauvignon Blanc. But they already had all of that covered at the price point that we would sort of be entering. And the one gap that they had was weirdly Gewürztraminer. And we chuckled about it so much that if you had told us that our first national label was going to be a Gewürztraminer, we would have told you to get lost. But in fact, we were growing a decent amount of Gewürztraminer. It does very, very well in the Monterey Appellation. It's a fun varietal to grow. We get pretty good yields on it, so we could give them a good price. And it just kind of became weirdly a logical place to start. And from that, then we were able to get in a Pinot Noir and a Chardonnay right. and other varietals that, were kind of more in our wheelhouse.
So looking back, what's the difference between private labels that go gangbusters and ones that die? Is it that the retail, without mentioning names, is it that the retailer doesn't get behind it? Or, what's the reason for success versus not success? I won't use the word failure.
Well, I think consumers are smart and they don't want something that looks like a private label, that looks like you didn't put a whole lot of effort into it. And I think that's where we became mm-hmm. successful in exclusive brands, is that because we had no contender in our national brand portfolio, we really put all of our passion into building private labels initially. And so they all pretty much had like a good story behind them. We made a website for them. We did in-store tastings. I mean, we really treated them like national brands, because if you get a private label into Kroger and it's at all their stores, it is a national brand, So we just did not make a distinction. And even to this day, we really, on the winemaking production side of it, kind of behind the curtain, when we do our approval tastings and all that, we do not make a distinction between, oh, this is our national brand and this is an exclusive label. We really kind of treat all of our wines as pretty precious and really wanting to put the best juice we can in the bottle for our consumer.
So how do you manage that many? I mean, how do you do the brand creation and who takes care of making sure that the portfolio is, first of all, you're not cannibalizing yourself and that everything is distinct? That's a huge amount of work. So how do you logistically manage it?
Well, we have a great marketing team and we have a fantastic winemaking team. I mean, it just comes down to people and processes. We've used platforms like Teamwork to make sure that all of our projects are being moved through the system and everybody is held accountable. I mean, that's really what it is it comes down to people. And you brought up an interesting point about cannibalization. How do you make sure you don't cannibalize your own brands? Well, the answer is you don't, because If somebody wants, and I know we'll talk about kind of better for you brands, but if somebody comes to us and wants a better for you brand because they think we're pretty good at making those low alcohol wines, we'll do that project. Because if we don't do that project, somebody else is going to. Mm-hmm. So we don't, again, really make that much of a distinction between, at least on the production side, between our global brands and our exclusive brands. And, we have a lot of vineyards. So, I mean, that's also the key to success, is that we're not buying wine off the bulk market and trying to just lower our COGS every year, you know, to try to make it work, we're really providing that consistent quality.
Yes. So this is the bit in the podcast where I'm going to tell you the numbers, because we were just talking about this before we started recording. So it's actually a really big business. You've got 10 estate vineyards. It's the 25th largest winery in the US. 2,000 plus acres of vineyards in Monterey County. Annual sales of 800,000 cases. 60% is private label. And the winery is powered by wind. That's really
brilliant. We have a 400-foot tall wind turbine that actually provides 200% of the power that we need to power an entire winery campus. So it's a pretty awesome thing.
What made you decide to do that? What was the day? Did somebody go out and go, gosh, it's windy. Oh, I've got an idea.
It is very windy. So that's number one. we were very interested. You know, sustainability has been a part of our DNA since we started. Solar panels really don't work in Monterey. It's just too wet and it takes up too much space and there's too much maintenance. And so really wind is the logical thing. There are other wind turbines in the Salinas Valley that, you know, power different things. So it really just became the logical choice to pursue renewable energy.
Oh, that's great. Now, the thing that you are, of course, among many things famous for, but things you're most famous for is your brand, Sunny with a Chance of Flowers. So can you tell me the story about how did you, you know, where does it come from? What, how did you build it?
I was at ProWine in March of 2019 and walking around and talking to, you know, ProWine is extraordinary. I always say it's the most inspiring and humbling 3 days of the year for me. And I started noticing as I was talking to people that there was really kind of this movement, especially overseas, to lower alcohol wines. There was a lot of talk about it. Governments wanting to have lower alcohol options available. So when we first started discussing a low alcohol wine, it felt like it was more for the export market versus the U.S. But then as we were conceptualizing, we brought that idea back and started talking with our winemaking team. Like, could you do a really great low alcohol wine? I, one weekend, was walking around the supermarket and I decided to walk every aisle and just sort of see what other products were doing. And one thing that I noticed is that every product had a better for you version of it, whether it was tomato sauce or dog food. I remember just standing in front of the water and going like, wow, there's like regular water and there's smart water.
Like, smart water. What is smart water?
What is smart? It makes you smart. And so you should pay more for it.
I need that water.
It's better. It's a better version of water. And I'm like, why do we not have this? And then I went and I was standing in front of the bacon and I was like, wow, when did there become so many choices for bacon? And holy cow, here is a turkey bacon with like zero sugar emblazoned across the front. And I'm like, there's zero
and
sugar.
And no plutonium either.
And so I went back to the wine aisle and I go, you know, there's really no healthier version of wine. Why not? And in talking to a lot of people, it was because everybody already knows that wine is the healthier version of alcohol. Wine doesn't need a healthier version because it already is healthier. I mean, that seems a little funny now because all alcohol is under attack. But this was in 2019, before the world had changed. And, I guess we just decided that's not valid. If there can be a healthier version of water, if there can be a healthier version of dog food, surely there can be a healthier version of wine.
Yeah, it's interesting because now you're talking about that. I remember, 2019 was the year that we started to see things like Dry Far Wines doing its campaign against sugar, and we saw all the clean wine and this whole, you know, and some of the new brands making outrageous claims about what was in wine and so on. So if you were seeing that in 2019, you know, what did you do next? Because of course the pandemic was coming, which you couldn't have known about. So how did you develop this lower alcohol wine?
Well, so, you know, first was the winemaking piece of it. You know, can we actually do it? And after I saw zero sugar turkey bacon, I told our winemakers, like, oh, besides being low alcohol and tasting really great, it also needs to be zero sugar. And they're like, okay, so you literally just took away our two primary tools to, you know, to cover any flaws in the grapes. You know, you need alcohol and sugar. And so it really pretty much undresses you when you take away those two tools. But we have a wonderful winemaker on our team, Casey De Cesare, and Casey did hundreds of different taste trials, really working on what type of technology worked best for this. We use reverse osmosis versus spinning cone, which we think is a much more gentle process, really preserves the aromas and flavors and texture and mouthfeel. And really our goal was just, let's come up with the best wine that we can, and would we drink it? And that was, you know, kind of a big piece of this as well, is that I really wanted a low alcohol wine available to me selfishly. And I thought, well, if I want it, there's got to be like millions of other people out there who want it as well. Yeah. You know, I get up early, I exercise, I have wine pretty much every day, every evening, I should say, qualify that. I don't day drink. Usually, sometimes, but not usually. But I do drink. I do evening drink.
It's a safe space for wine drinkers, Heidi.
Okay, good. I do evening drink regularly. I would say, you know, 360 days a year. And so as I'm getting older, you know, I started to feel a little ripped off that after a glass of wine, I felt like, I should probably stop because my alarm's going to go off at 5:30 in the morning and I want to go out for a run and not feel crummy. So I really wanted that lower alcohol wine. Sunny with a Chance of Flowers is 9% alcohol. And it is dramatic how much better you feel after drinking a couple glasses of 9% wine versus drinking a couple glasses of 14% wine. It's a pretty big difference.
Yeah. I really like gin and tonic, and I actually can't drink it anymore because it just wrecks my sleep. It tells you something about my age. But okay. So when did you know that you? And so you started with the Sauvignon Blanc, I think, which I think the aromatics often make up for some of, you know, what can be taken away. But when did you go, yep, that's what we've got.
Yeah, well, we started when we launched in 2020, which was a very interesting time to launch, the summer of 2020. We launched with a Sauvignon Blanc, a Chardonnay, and a Pinot Noir. And, you know, once we had the blend, we really started talking to buyers, you know, retail buyers about it. And, you know, we were just looking for somebody to say yes, to kind of give us the green light to be able to produce it. And we got, you know, pretty mixed reviews just conceptually, not about the wine itself. Once they tasted it, they really loved it. But just conceptually, you know, was there a place in the market for a low alcohol wine?
Isn't that interesting? Looking back, you know, now you think, you know, everyone would be clamoring for it. But it's just interesting that even 5 years ago, people were like, oh, I'm not sure about this.
Yeah, but do you know who really got it? All the women.
Yeah.
Really, our first two yeses were both women buyers, both, you know, kind of in their 30s, and they totally got it. They're like, yes, you know what? I would drink this wine. And that was, you know, part of where I spoke from was like, hey, I've got, back then my daughter was in her late 20s. I've got a daughter in her late 20s. I got a mom in her 80s. And then there's me. And all three of us have a great use occasion for a low alcohol wine. Yeah. My daughter wants to drive over to her girlfriend's house to watch The Bachelor on a Monday night and be able to drive home and be safe, but have a glass or two of wine. I want to sit at home on my couch and drink wine on a weeknight and get up in the morning and go for a run. My mom just wants to still drink wine. You know, she doesn't want her doctor telling her, sorry, you know, you're too old to be drinking alcohol. My mom's been a lifelong wine drinker. She's now 88 and in amazing health. And she drinks her two little glasses of Sunny with a Chance of Flowers every single evening. First glass at 5, second glass at 6 with her meal. And she... It's literally, when I brought Sunny over to her home, when we first launched it, she called me up crying and said, you gave me back something that I thought I had lost. When you get to be my age, people only take things away from you. They never give you anything, and you gave me something back.
Oh, goodness gracious. Somebody told me today, and this could be an apocryphal story, but somebody told me today that they were selling a lot of their non-alc wines to nursing homes because nursing homes won't allow people to have alcohol, but the residents still want the dignity of a glass of wine sometimes with dinner and so on.
And retirement communities, you know, I think people in retirement communities probably like to drink. If I was in a retirement community, I think I'd be drinking all the time.
I think I would be drinking all the time as well. Yes, I think that's a very important use for.
Yes, you play pickleball and, you know, you have a glass of Sunny with a Chance of Flowers.
Okay, so when you developed it and you started going to buyers and retailers, was it the wine first and then you came up with the brand afterwards, or had you already developed the brand as well?
We had developed the brand as well. I worked with just the most terrific person, Teresa Scripps, developing Sunny with a Chance of Flowers. She was the one who actually came up with the name. And so we had the brand concept. We had it all laid out on this fantastic PowerPoint that now I look back at and I cringe at it, but it was fantastic at the time.
And, I'll send you some of my PowerPoints and then you'll look at yours and go, it's amazing. What a professional PowerPoint this is, you'll say.
I always say that if you're not embarrassed by the PowerPoint that you did 2 years ago, then you just haven't progressed enough.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, it's a fantastic name, Sunny with a Chance of, I mean, it's a really joyous kind of name. Was that a spontaneous, yeah, I've got it, or did you spend like days crossing out names and coming up with new ones?
Well, so Teresa Scripps came up with a name, and she said she lives in Napa, and she was driving one day and the sun was like coming through the trees on this beautiful Napa road, and it just popped into her head, and she quickly wrote it down as she was driving and just kept it in her back pocket. And then we were introduced by a mutual friend, and you know, we develop brand concepts all the time because we're always trying to like pitch different concepts to retailers. And so we met and we're talking about it, and literally she was almost out of the office when she goes, "Hey, can I just show you one last thing?" And then she showed me Sunny with a Chance of Flowers, and I'm like, "Oh my God, I love that. That just makes me smile. I got to show this to other people." And so I ran around the office showing it to everybody, and all the women loved it. The men were a little like, "Wait, so what does it mean?" <I'm> like, okay. I think I know my target market.
I think you do. So going back to 2019, there was a lot going on in the culture. It wasn't just about, you know, the clean wine brands and so on, but I mean, there was clean beauty emerging, the whole wellness culture was emerging. Why do you think that you saw this and so many people in wine didn't see it or were even resistant to it?
I guess, you know, we're small and agile. We don't have layers to get something done. I'm sure people did see it, and it's just, in larger companies, you know, that line from an innovative idea to production, there's probably a lot more stops along the way. You know, we did zero research. We had nothing to validate our claims.
Okay. I was going to ask you, so what about your, tell me about your research. And it's none, apparently.
Zero, like none. Like I wouldn't even know. I mean, we do research now to try to understand the consumer better and understand our attributes and how those resonate and all that. But back then, we didn't have the budget. I didn't want to take the time. Our research was just like kind of a hunch, and it really was taking cues from every other product. Like you mentioned, beauty products. Yes, there's a clean, you know, kind of better for you, if you will, version of everything.
Yeah,
you know, this concept of mindfulness is just like permeated throughout every single product.
So I just want to go back to the research. So you said you didn't do it, but now you do. Was it just because you were selling so many cases, you now had the resources to do research, or did somebody say to you, you should really do research? What made you start down that path?
Well, we started down the path, you know, kind of on our own because we wanted to better understand who the consumer for Sunny with a Chance of Flowers was and better hone our messaging. You know, we have three primary attributes: zero sugar, 85 calories per serving, 9% alcohol. So what order do you put that in? We're also certified sustainable. We're the only certified sustainable, better for you brand on the market. We're also vegan and gluten-free and a women-led brand. I mean, we have
no plutonium.
And no plutonium. And it's a long name to begin with. Sunny with a Chance of Flowers. That's a lot of words. So we always say, like, we have a lot to say. What's the most effective way of saying it, of communicating, you know, who we are and what this wine stands for, what is important to today's consumer? Like, we know we have a great wine with great attributes, but you only have a moment to communicate the most important things. So how, what's our hierarchy of messaging and how do we most effectively do that? So that's why we started doing the research. So we've done two pretty robust research studies. The first one we did in 2021 and the second one we just finished.
So tell me about that. What can you share? I love research. What can you share from that?
Well, you know, there were a couple great little nuggets. We did a quantitative study of 600 better for you alcohol beverage consumers. So in this case, we really were already kind of speaking to the person who would buy our wine if they knew about it. One thing that I thought was really interesting is that 80% value transparency and labeling.
I want to talk to you about that too. Yeah.
So we talk about that a lot, like how much transparency, you know, that is a big, big topic in our industry. We were able to really dig into the attributes and discovered that zero sugar was the number one thing. Like a very, very high number of people are very sugar conscious these days and really seek to lower sugar like throughout their entire diet. So when they see zero sugar, that is very meaningful to them. Calorie reduction was the next and alcohol was the next, which to me, like I kind of like, for me personally, the lower alcohol is more important than the lower calorie. But for these consumers, it was lower calorie over lower alcohol. But my very favorite thing that I learned was that 62% of these people studied reported that relaxing at home alone is their top occasion for drinking a better for you alcoholic beverage. And it really made us change the way that we talk to our consumer. I think so often in the wine industry, we position wine as this thing that you have to have the perfect cheese and charcuterie board. Yeah. You have to have your beautiful friends all over, and you have to be at a beautiful long wooden table that has, you know, fresh flowers on it. And that's a lovely occasion, but like, how often do we actually do that in our lives? Most people are working Monday through Friday. They just want to open a dependable bottle of wine that didn't cost them more than $15 that they can plop on the couch and drink and have no shame in that. Like, I don't, you know, they want to feel like I'm not at my book club meeting. I'm not getting together with all my girlfriends or my guy friends or whatever it is. I'm just spending a night alone and really treating myself to a glass or two of wine.
So what sort of age group are we talking about here?
Well, this really spanned. So this was ages 25 to like 55. So it was a pretty broad group. And there are some differences between the different age groups, but that drinking alone at home, which sounds sad, but it's not. Like, why is that sad? There's nothing sad. I hope there's nothing sad because I do it all the time. There's nothing sad about enjoying a glass of wine on your own and treating yourself after the end of the day.
Yeah, I just want to talk a bit about the transparency because I find this really interesting. And I find it really interesting how resistant the alcohol trade in general is towards any kind of nutrition labeling when it would clearly be at this point in time an asset to do it. But maybe that's for a different time. But when you put a product out on the market and you make a thing about the fact that it's lower calorie and lower sugar, how do you do that in a way that doesn't disparage the whole category, given that you're also producing wines that presumably are, you know, more conventional in character?
Well, you don't disparage the whole category. You know, you're positive in your messaging. It drives me crazy. Like, we don't even want to go down this rabbit hole because then I will make you cut it from the from the podcast. It drives me crazy. Some of the claims, you know, these, you know, that there's 70 additives and, you know, that they're being used so pervasively. It's super damaging to the industry.
Yeah, no, I'm on the... I've been on the personal warpath about this for since about 2019, but you know, there are now people who are. I mean, this probably doesn't have anything to do with your brand. I'm just making a comment. You know, how many people are talking about sugar, but in a way that makes it sound like everybody else's wine is completely full of sugar.
Right.
So just quick question before I get, what do you do with the ethanol that you take away once you've done the reverse osmosis? What happens to the actual alcohol?
It's an interesting question. The technical name for it is strip water.
Strip water. Oh, come on. That's a gin waiting to happen.
Yeah, I know. We thought, wow, we need to do a particular wine for strip clubs, but it didn't seem like there was that big of a market in that. So, you know, it is. Okay, I'll say, let's talk offline about that. you know, it can be repurposed. It can be repurposed into, you know, like a flavored low alcohol wine product. It can be sold, you know, there are some uses for it. And we
does that mean you actually get two streams of income out of the same
potentially
product?
Potentially. Oh, but we kind of produce more strip water than we have a use for.
Strip water. That is such a great name. I love that. Okay, so the other thing that's happened since you've put out Sunny with the Chance of Flowers, of course, is that this market, a lot of people have now seen the opportunity. So, you know, you're kind of the incumbent or the first mover in the market or one of the first movers, but how do you maintain your position against what is going to be increasingly ferocious competition?
Yeah, it is. It's tough because, you know, we're still... you know, kind of a mid-sized winery, and a lot of the larger wineries have these brands now. And oftentimes they've launched a lower alcohol brand that is an offshoot of an existing parent brand that has a lot of brand equity, you know, like a Kim Crawford or something. And that's very difficult for us to go up against. I think one of our selling points is that we are a standalone brand. You know, we are very purposefully made as a better for you wine that stands on its own. I think the only thing that we can really do is just to continue producing a product that we believe is the best tasting low alcohol wine on the market. We submit it to scoring publications all the time, and every single one of our 7 SKUs has a 90 plus point rating. And that's because we're very careful with how we grow the grapes and how we remove the alcohol and how we make the wine. And you know, it's, to us, this is not a less than wine. Like, this is the star of our portfolio. So we really put a ton of love and passion and care into producing these wines.
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken to lots of people in this space, and they say the number one mistake that people make is thinking they can use their sort of leftover wine for this, but you actually have to start with really, really good wine for it to work. Maybe
absolutely.
Yeah. So, okay, so did you say you've got 7 SKUs now?
We do.
Gosh. And what is the moment that you think, oh, we need another SKU? Is it when a retailer says we need something to differentiate, or do you go, oh, here's the opportunity, or how do you make that decision?
It happens in a variety of ways. I mean, so we launched with a Sauvignon Blanc, a Chardonnay, and a Pinot Noir, and then we really wanted to do a cab. And that took a lot more work to really figure out how we were going to make a Cabernet that delivered on being a Cabernet. You know, obviously it doesn't taste like a 14.5% Napa Cab, but it's delicious and juicy, and it's a wonderful wine. And so in that case, we always intended to do a Cabernet, but we really wanted to make sure that we were very proud of it. And, you know, we always come down to, would we drink it ourselves? Would we pour it for our friends? And it doesn't get released unless the answer is yes. We have a bubbly rosé. We really felt like the category needed something that's sparkling. And then our most recent release is a Pinot Grigio. And the Sunny with a Chance of Flowers Pinot Grigio has done terrifically. We just launched it last year. And in that case, it's like a Pinot Grigio is going to do really well in the better for you space. It's kind of a logical wine to put into that low alcohol space. Consumers love Pinot Grigio. Our consumer loves Pinot Grigio.
So it's just occurred to me that, you know, you've got this fantastic, you know, product that's doing really, really well. So you've really, you know, were prescient in seeing what was going to happen. But those same forces around wellness and stuff, how have they affected your other SKUs and private labels? Have you had to retire any brands because of what's going on in the market, or have you had to modify any of them at all?
We have retired a few brands. They've mostly been at our own volition. Like, we've tried to cut off the tail, try to gain some production efficiencies. So sometimes what happens when you have a brand in the market is, you know, it starts at a certain level and then it just starts to taper off. And at some point, you know, you have to call the time of death. It's really hard to kill a SKU, to kill a brand, because somebody always cares about it. And so you have to be a little bit brutal and just say, we're just not producing this anymore.
What's the thing that makes you go, it's gone, we have to have the funeral? Is there a particular metric or series of metrics, or is it just a gut feeling? Like, what's the moment that you go, it's funeral time?
It's definitely numbers. It's 100% numbers. It's, we're holding the inventory for too long. You know, we have a certain quantity of cases that we have to produce on the bottom line in order for it to be efficient. So, you know, we can't do a 900 case bottling run and then have that take a year to deplete. You know, we have to have efficiency. So we have to have a higher number on the bottling line, and those cases have to deplete over a reasonable period of time. You know, ideally like 6 months or less. So it really 100% comes down to the numbers. In fact, we have a quarterly SKU rationalization meeting, the SKU rat, and we
split water.
Yeah, we're literally having it next week. I just got the email yesterday of the list of SKUs that is on the SKU rat list. And so, you know, it's always a heated, passionate discussion. You know, there's, like I said, it's every SKU is important to somebody. And at the end of the day, you got to kind of come down on what are the numbers telling us to do, and we need to have the courage to do that.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so switching to marketing, when you've got these SKUs and you're a medium-sized winery and you don't have the budget of a Diageo, how do you market, especially what are your digital strategies?
Yeah, well, you do have to get, you know, pretty scrappy. And, you know, luckily with Sunny with a Chance of Flowers, because it does have so much to say and it's such a joyful brand, it is so much fun to market this brand digitally. It's the brand that wants to be in photos. It's the brand that wants to be filmed. So there's a lot to mine there. You know, we're doing all the things, you know, the Facebook, the Instagram, we're now on TikTok. We do lots of things in the digital space, whether it's geo-targeted advertising. We run a digital sweepstakes twice a year in January and February. It's about winning workout gear, you know, a gift card to buy yourself new workout gear for resolution season. And then in the spring going into summer, we run my favorite program, which is win a year of fresh flowers delivered to your door by entering the sweepstakes.
Do you expect you're going to do this in Europe?
What's that? No, I don't know. Well, you could enter Felicity and see if you win. We'll figure it out.
Right.
I'll send you flowers every month.
That'd be sustainable. Yeah.
And next year in 2026, we're actually the winner will win a year of fresh flowers for themselves and another person. So they can choose, you know, their mom, their boyfriend, their sister, whatever it is. So we're kind of up in the air.
I can imagine that must go off on social media. Do you get lots of pictures of people surrounded by flowers and things?
Well, we do, and people love it, and we get tons and tons of entrants. And the really beautiful thing is the people that win, and we do three winners, you know, each time, and we get the nicest, most heartfelt letters from them that just like thanking us profusely that it's like the best thing that's ever happened to them. And you know what? It doesn't cost that much. You know, we intentionally keep the spend to under $600 so that we don't have to send them a tax form. You know, in the US, you would have to do that if you receive a gift over $600. So this is not a huge marketing spend, but it is very authentic to our brand. It's very heartfelt. You know, our marketing team, we love doing it. We get excited letting the winners know that they've won and sending those flowers every month. And we also get a ton of email addresses and phone numbers. We're able to, you know, put together, like right now we have over 35,000 email addresses that we send emails to twice a week.
Amazing. That's a fantastic idea. And do you get thank you letters from the Florists Association?
No, but we should.
Yes, you should. What ungrateful people for such a nice industry. Seriously.
Exactly.
I'll send them a rude note on your behalf. Okay,
thank you.
You are part of the Wine Market Council, so you don't just have your own point of view about how things work, but you've certainly been able to see the industry, which is in a lot of distress at the moment, not simply in California, but internationally. What are everybody's got an opinion from, you know, premiumization has cannibalized that all important $12 to $15 area to people just don't have money, to wellness and health, to all of the above. What's your perspective on what's happening in the market?
Oh, you saved the easy question for last. You know, there are so many factors happening simultaneously that it's really hard to kind of tease it apart and understand what's really driving it. I mean, I think the economy is a huge piece of it. Obviously competing products like cannabis. I think, you know, the isolation, you know, young people staying on screens. I think COVID really changed the way, particularly for young people, how they live their lives. It concerns me, you know, that I think there's a lot of fear baked into young people now, where they're worried about causing themselves harm. I think the anti-alcohol messaging is huge. You know, I sometimes just want to tell younger people, you know, lighten up, just calm down. Have some fun, you know, like it's, yes, of course, it's good to do all these health-minded things. I'm very health conscious. I also love to go out and have one glass too many and laugh my head off with my friends and maybe feel just a little bit crummy the next day, but just drink lots of water and know it'll pass. And boy, that was a wonderful trade-off for a fantastically fun evening. And I hope we can get back to that, where there's not so much of this kind of pervasive fear that we have to be so protective of ourselves in every way whatsoever. You know, we get into a car without thinking about it, and really the risk of driving in a car is far greater than the risk of having a glass or two of wine to relax and have a nice time.
Yeah, I mean, I've been reading a lot of, you know, literature around this culture of risk aversion. And it's very interesting because you can see it in adults as well. I think we have a whole sort of, so it's particularly pronounced among young people, but I think it's an all pervasive, sense of risk aversion, which is a different conversation. But so what are you hearing back from the market? Are you hearing that it's, is this, in your opinion, is this cyclical and when people have got more money, it will pick up? Or do you think that the market is fundamentally changing at the moment?
Oh, boy. I ask myself this question all the time. I mean, the honest answer is I really don't know, Felicity.
That is an honest answer because most people tell me they do know.
I would like to think that it's cyclical. There are some factors, though, which don't feel cyclical. You know, the economy is obviously cyclical, but cannabis is not. You know, anti-alcohol, I hope that the industry is able to come together to combat that and to put forth a message that's more true and honest.
All right. So moving on from the global picture, back to you. What's further ahead for, you know, what's next for you? I mean, you've obviously got an enormously creative company. If you can manage 80 SKUs plus, you can manage anything by the sound of it. So what's next?
Well, after our SKU rat meeting next week, there's not going to be 80.
SKU rat meeting. That is so funny.
Actually, there's less than 80
people,
already.
We have to have a SKU rat. Oh, again? Okay.
Once a quarter. Yes. What's ahead? You know, we're just going to keep doing what we're doing here. You know, it is a very, very tough time for the industry, no doubt. And we have felt it quite significantly. You know, Sunny with a Chance of Flowers has been a bright spot and all that. So we're really continuing to focus very strongly on Sunny and growing that out and, you know, making the marketing investment behind the brand that's necessary to grab attention, you know, not just among consumers, but among distributors, you know, just kind of getting our products through the funnel and onto the shelf is a challenge in and of itself. So, you know,
will you be at Provine next year?
You know, we will not. We're going to Wine Paris. We're going to Wine Paris. So sorry, Pro Wine. You know, I've been to Pro Wine.
Well, you know, I'm in Germany. I'm going to have to cut this bit out. There's been sound of horror in Dusseldorf. It's true though. I think even in these straitened times, there's people all over the world saying to their bosses, I just have to go to Paris. It's where everything is happening.
Paris just is going to be a little easier because Dusseldorf, it's quite expensive, you know, and it's actually cheaper to go to Paris. Yeah. And I've been to Dusseldorf so many times that I'm looking forward to changing it up next year. Many, many people are doing both. And I think that's fantastic. You know, we would do both, but, you know, kind of we're being conscious of our budgets and all of that. And so we're, for the first time in a very, very long time, we're just going to go to Paris.
Well, I'll see you in Paris in February. And on that note, thank you very much for your time, Heidi.
Thank you so much, Felicity. It's been an honor, actually. I'm an avid listener of the podcast. The fact that I'm on here is just like, it's kind of a big deal to me. So thank you very much for having me.
I'm definitely not cutting that out. Thank you very much.
Okay.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.